2012, we had 5 officer-involved shootings. That's the most we've ever had, as far back as we could count.
The rising toll of officer-involved shootings in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 8th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a court decision that has big implications for tribal lands in Alaska.
It's a very important tool for purposes of tribal self-determination. And unfortunately, it's been a tool that has been denied to Alaska tribes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Anchorage Police Department officials say the man shot and killed by officers in a downtown supermarket parking lot on Friday night had a semi-automatic handgun. The man was identified as Detlef Wolf, a 27-year-old with a long criminal record. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Friday night, a security guard called police to report a possibly drunk man slumped over the wheel of a sports utility vehicle at the Cars grocery store in Fairview. According to Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew, the officers approached the vehicle, rapped on the window of the SUV, and saw that the man inside had a semi-automatic handgun. Mew describes what happened.
Things went very fast from there. They hollered at the person behind the wheel, who we now know to be Mr. Wolf, to put his hands up. Instead of doing that, he produced the gun, cracked the car door open, raised the gun, leaned over his shoulder, and pointed it at the closest officer. And at that point, both officers returned fire.
The victim was identified as Detlef Wolf, age 27. Mew says officers boxed the car in and illuminated the area before approaching because they believed the man could be intoxicated and they wanted to prevent him from driving away. The shooting happened just before backup arrived. 5 shots were fired by 2 officers. An autopsy is underway. Wolf had a long record with the courts, stretching back to 2000, with many cases involving alcohol and weapons. Chief Mew says law enforcement leaders are very concerned about the increasing number of officer-involved shootings in Anchorage.
In 2012, we had 5 officer-involved shootings. That's the most we've ever had, as far back as we could count. 2 of those were fatal. 3 of them were not fatal. That same year, state troopers had 8, which I think is very high for them as well. We're both concerned and trying to determine how to attribute that. Is society getting more violent? Are officers acting quicker? You know, I don't know the answers to those questions yet.
So far in 2013, the APD has had 3 officer-involved shootings, 2 of them fatal. In January, officers attended a use of force training. The State Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals is investigating Friday's shooting. Officers must be in fear of imminent, serious physical injury or death to themselves or a third person in order to legally use deadly force. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Protesters with the Anti-Abortion Center for Bioethical Reform held up large signs across from the state capitol building in Juneau last week, depicting graphic images of aborted fetuses. In response to complaints, some state employees tried to block the protest signs with official vehicles. The incident led Governor Sean Parnell and state Senate Republicans to charge the demonstrators free speech rights had been violated. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
The signs were hard to miss, showing what protesters claimed to be the bloody aftermath of an abortion. Officials at the Diamond Courthouse, directly across from the Capitol building, received complaints about the images. So Alaska Court System Deputy Administrative Director Doug Wolliver says a longtime court employee requested state vehicles park in front of the signs.
Our employee at the court system had received some complaints about the graphic nature of the photographs, particularly given that it was by a daycare center, I guess, in the Tom Stewart building. His thought was, well, maybe we can just put some vans in the parking area, which is, you know, for loading and unloading and all kinds of other regular daily uses anyway, as a way to try to create a buffer.
Some protesters apparently complained to a state lawmaker, and by Wednesday, a video of the vehicles parked in front of the signs was posted on the Restoring Liberty PAC website, run by failed U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller. Another heavily edited video posted Friday shows demonstrators trying to block a van from parking in the loading and unloading zone in front of the courthouse. A Capitol security official asks a protester not to stand or sit in the middle of the street. When the man refuses, the security guard attempts to escort him to the sidewalk. In the ensuing struggle, the protester falls to the ground. On the Senate floor Friday, Wasilla Republican Mike Dunleavy called the incident a blatant violation of free speech.
These protesters were not yelling and screaming. They were not saying anything. They were standing there silently. Yet we had several vans, State of Alaska vans, parked in front of those protesters. We had one of the protesters, it's on the video, that was manhandled. This is an outrage.
Governor Parnell released a statement blaming the situation on employees with the court system, the legislature, and the Department of Administration, and calling their actions totally inappropriate. Eagle River Senator Fred Dyson took it a step further while talking to reporters at a Senate majority press conference on Friday.
I suspect whoever was responsible will at least get talked to about it and may get time off to work on the resume.
Andy Mills, a spokesman for Administration Commissioner Becky Holtberg, said the department's vehicles only blocked the protest for 45 minutes on Tuesday. He said the employees involved would receive training about not interfering with demonstrations. Legislative Affairs Director Pam Varney denied involvement by employees at her agency. Bolivar says the court employee realizes it was the wrong decision. However, he says calling it a violation of free speech might be a little strong.
Well, I don't know if it violated free speech. They were still on the sidewalk. They were still visible. I think they moved down a few feet. But it was inappropriate on the part of the court. So everybody, I think, agrees it was not the right call to make.
According to the Juneau Police Department, the Center for Bioethical Reform did not apply for a parade permit, which would have been needed for a demonstration anywhere off the sidewalk. No arrests were made, and the protest wrapped up without further incident Wednesday afternoon. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
An administrative judge has tossed out the suspensions of two prosecutors in the botched corruption case against former Senator Ted Stevens. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Judge Benjamin Gutman reversed the suspensions of former prosecutors Joseph Bottini and James Gecky. The two appealed their suspensions, which have not been enforced yet. Bottini, now an assistant U.S. attorney in Anchorage, was suspended for 40 days without pay, and Gecky, an assistant U.S. attorney in Washington State, lost 15 days of pay. The ruling says the two received harsher than necessary punishments because the Department of Justice did not follow its own procedures. DOJ had a senior attorney investigate the two instead of a subordinate lawyer. Bottini and Gecky were originally charged with prosecutorial misconduct. They failed to follow legal procedure by not offering up character-damaging information about their star witness, disgraced former VICO executive Bill Allen. The Department of Justice would not comment for the story. A spokesman says the department is reviewing the matter. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage residents weigh in on the continuing April snow accumulation.
Bring it on.
I don't want ski season to end.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Anchorage, the ultimate cross-trainer for finding your place in the world, home to stellar academic programs and an exciting campus energy with all of the thrills you'll only find outside of an office or classroom. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
An audit of the Kinnick Arm Bridge finds that the agency handling the project has overstated its traffic forecasts. Government auditors expect substantially less toll revenue as a result, leaving the state at risk of having to make up the shortfall. The bridge, which would link Anchorage and Port McKenzie, has a price tag of $1.6 billion. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, the agency behind the project, anticipates that it would pay for itself within 30 years of being built through drive driver's tolls. But the audit released on Saturday says that Kubota's financial plan is unreasonably optimistic and that it's based on inflated population estimates for the area. Kubota is disputing the report, saying that the auditors failed to factor in potential development of the Port McKenzie area. A bill advancing the project is scheduled for a vote on the House floor tonight. A joint House and Senate vote today approved almost all of Governor Parnell's appointments to various state boards and commissions, all but one. Vince Webster, Parnell's choice for reappointment for a third three-year term on the State Board of Fisheries, was turned down by a one-vote margin.
Total combined, 29 yeas, 30 nays.
And so, by a vote of 29 yeas and 30 nays, Mr. Webster has failed to be confirmed.
Senate President Charlie Huggins asked for the vote tally to be read a second time. The vote came after an hour of spirited debate on the merits of Webster's previous work with the State Fish Board. Webster had gained the ire of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association due to a Board of Fish move in March that lowered escapement goals for Kenai River late run Chinook salmon. On Friday, the Sports Fishing Association issued a call to block Webster's appointment. A bill that would give cities and boroughs in Alaska the ability to deal with derelict and abandoned vessels is advancing in the legislature. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
On Friday, House Bill 131 received unanimous support in the Alaska House. The prime sponsor of the bill is Representative Paul Seaton from Homer. He says the bill addresses an important issue.
Because the municipalities didn't have authority to take care of vessels, just simply because our statutes haven't kept up with the state getting out of the harbor business and transferring that authority to the municipalities. Now the people with the responsibility have the authority to deal with the problem.
Back in October, the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators passed a resolution requesting stronger municipal powers in regards to abandoned and derelict vessels. That resolution was supported by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. House Bill 131 basically allows a state agency or municipality to remove a derelict vessel from state waters if the vessel obstructs navigation or constitutes a danger to the environment. The bill also stipulates that a vessel that has been denied entrance to a harbor by a state agency or municipality may not be stored on the waters of the state for more than 14 consecutive days unless all hazardous materials and petroleum products have been removed. Seaton says House Bill 131 will help clear up who has the authority to deal with dangerous vessels.
Down in Homer, Jackaloff Bay, there were two vessels that sunk this year. They were denied entrance into the harbor because they were in such derelict condition, but then they were anchored in the state waters and they sunk. And then the state was left with the responsibility because they were also leaking some fuel. So what this does is says if you're denied entrance into a harbor, if you store for more than 14 days in state waters, you have to remove all the hazardous waste.
House Bill 131 also gives a state agency or municipality the authority to dispose of vessels that have been left unattended for 30 days if the vessel's on public property or on private property without the authorization of the owner of the property. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A Washington, D.C. District Court decision quietly released on Easter Sunday has huge implications for Alaska tribal and state lands jurisdiction. The court found the Secretary of Interior has the authority to take land into trust for Alaska tribes, something most believed was not possible after the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed. Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller argued the case on behalf of Alaska tribes. She told APRN's Lori Townsend the ruling is an important recognition of tribal self-determination and trust status will protect tribes from lawsuits, taxation, and foreclosure.
It's a very important tool for purposes of tribal self-determination. And unfortunately, it's been a tool that has been denied to Alaska tribes for some time. Alaska tribes have been in the situation as being treated like second-hand citizens. And while Alaska tribes have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government, the state has long believed that that is somehow different from tribes in the lower 48 and that the kinds of powers and immunities that tribes in Alaska have are somehow less than those in tribes possessed in the lower 48. This decision makes very clear that the secretary does not have the legal authority to essentially discriminate against Alaska tribes.
The state's perspective on this is that ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, extinguished Aboriginal title, that there isn't Indian country here, and that because of that, tribes in Alaska are different than lower 48 tribes, that being able to place land into trust will go against the tenets of ANCSA.
Well, the state is a little confused. First of all, I do agree with the state that ANCSA did extinguish Aboriginal land claims, but trust lands and secretary authority to consider exercising discretion to place lands in trusts is not about claims. It's not about Aboriginal claims. It's about the secretary's discretion to take tribal lands, and we're not talking about ANCSA lands here. We're talking about lands that tribes own in fee and place those lands to hold them under trust for purposes of protection.
How much non-ANCSA lands do tribes have?
Not much. For instance, in this case, the plaintiffs that brought this lawsuit, one of them is the Kenaitse. They are a small tribal community, is surrounded by a larger community, and they possess a piece of land that's been conveyed to the tribe that they want to build a community center on. But they want to make sure that that land and their investment in that land is going to be protected against borough taxation or any other potential possibilities that may arise in the future.
If the secretary takes tribal land into trust in Alaska, is it then considered Indian country?
It is considered an area that the federal government has shared jurisdiction over because of its joint ownership interest in the lands and because it's in trust. And so generally, it is an area that is viewed as being an area that the federal government will have to agree to any kind of potential development projects. So to some extent, it does put in place of the state, the federal government. But again, that's the means of protecting the tribal land base itself.
Will this have any impact on the Alaska Native Corporations, the ANCs?
I don't see that impact. And the reason why, again, is because all this does is allow Alaska tribes to put forward a petition. And that petition process allows all interested parties to weigh in with their views as to whether a particular parcel should be put into trust or not. Now, keep in mind that the parcels that these particular plaintiff tribes are interested in were never ANCSA lands. And if it was a piece of ANCSA land, then the corporation would have to agree because they would be the surface owners. So that's a very unique situation that really is not addressed in these regulations.
Heather Kendall Miller is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. Tomorrow, we'll hear the state's perspective on the decision from Alaska's Attorney General.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts, learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
The National Weather Service is downgrading its forecasted snow amounts for the latest April storm to hit the Anchorage area. Over the weekend, 10 inches of snow fell in East Anchorage and on the hillside. Highland Road in Eagle River received an impressive 29 inches of fluff. This morning, the National Weather Service was predicting another 9 to 15 inches could fall by Tuesday, but now it looks like the storm totals will be closer to 4 to 8 inches. Jason Ossenmacher is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service.
We saw much lighter snowfall today than we were anticipating. And even tonight, the main show, when we get it moving in tonight, is probably not going to be as impressive as we thought before as well. So really, just a very slight shift in the pattern to the east made all the difference, this event.
Still, Ossenmacher says snowfall rates should pick up in Anchorage around 7 tonight. With a foot of new snow on the ground, April is looking more like midwinter. APRN intern Alex Duerre sampled some opinion this morning on the weather at local coffee shops.
Personally, I love it. I'm heading up to Arctic Man in a few days and bringing my snow machines, bringing my skis. So, I think it's a little gift that Mother Nature gave us here.
Bring it on. I don't want ski season to end. Yeah, a little bit of everything, backcountry, resort, whatever, man, where the snow's at.
And where you usually go skiing?
I just got back from a sweet week in Valdez, so I'm just kind of laying low until the weather clears, and then it's going to be game on again after this storm passes.
Oh, so some fresh powder, huh?
Yeah.
I'm heading to Hawaii tomorrow, so I'm looking for white sand instead of white snow. I don't care today.
For work, you know, it's really good for all the body shops around town, but on a personal level, it's kind of horrible because I was gearing up, getting ready all my tents and sleeping bags for hiking this year, and, you know, it's kind of disheartening on that end.
Well, I was a little bit disappointed to see the snow. I was definitely ready for spring, but on the other hand, I could maybe use a couple more runs of snowboarding, so we'll make the best of it.
Tired of it. I can't take it anymore.
So why are you in Alaska if you don't like the snow?
All my family lives here, and I think now, just recently, the last couple of years, I've been getting tired of it because I've lived here all my life. And the summers are great, but the winters are rough, to say the least.
A sampling of opinion on the new snow this morning in Anchorage from APRN intern Alex Duerre. Modern technology has changed how Alaskans gather their food, both in urban and rural areas. As part of our ongoing series looking at how we define our culture as Alaskans, Anne Hillman examines some of those changes and some that haven't changed at all.
As I walked through the grocery store in Anchorage, I whipped out my cell phone.
I'm by the crackers. Do you need bread or anything?
Cell phones can change the entire urban food gathering experience, making it faster, more efficient, and more forgiving. Other technologies have had actually a much more profound impact on food gathering in rural Alaska. Elder Frank Matumiak from New Ixit, a small town on the North Slope, says that access to snow machines, outboard motors, and other technology has made hunting and gathering significantly easier. People can go out and hunt for short periods of time rather than for months or entire seasons. But the technology comes at a cost.
Nowadays, you have boats and high-powered rifles, and you can go from one place to another place in no time. But to have that, you have to work. And if you didn't work, you couldn't get there. And now it's kind of a situation where, you know, if you had a good job, then you can still do other stuff.
He says that people rely on the new technology and don't have other means of hunting anymore, like dog teams. That means if families don't make enough money to have boats or snow machines or buy fuel, then they can't go hunting. Hazel Konakinan is a recreation coordinator for the town of New Ixit. She tries to make up for the teaching gap by hiring guides and boats to take kids on hunting trips.
Well, some people don't have boats, and so that's why we take them out, so they could have a chance to go, you know, hunting with the adults that know how to hunt.
Okay.
Even though their parents know how, but we just want to, you know, take them out to let them learn.
She also teaches them traditional hunting skills during community festival games.
We do like harpoon throw, you know, and then we do bow and arrow. We do muckluck race, and we do, what else? Rifle shooting contests. We do tent setup race.
In New Ixit, which is 97 miles from the whaling grounds by boat, airplanes are even being used for whaling. Whaling Captain Billy Uyuk explains that the oil companies agreed to pay to fly the butchered whales from the hunting grounds back to Nuiqsut as part of the conflict avoidance agreement.
It's easier to fly them than bring them in the snow machine because it'll take about 20, 30 trips in order to go haul them for the snow machines.
But some technology never changes. No matter how the whale makes it back, the only way to store 75 tons of bowhead whale is in a hand-dug cellar in the permafrost.
25 feet down, 18 feet long, about 14 feet wide.
A ladder leads down the narrow hole to the open area that's covered with fresh snow before being filled with whale. But massive meat storage isn't the only part of hunting that can't be replaced by modern technology. Josiah Pukatuk from Barrow says you have to use the information gathered by elders to understand the environment. For example,
if you pay attention to the current out in the ocean during spring whaling, pay attention to the current, usually the winds will follow between 10 and 15 hours later. And that kind of information, you know, you got to, someone sometime had to learn the hard way.
He's also learning to navigate without his GPS in case of emergencies. And Matumiak stresses that even with all of the new technologies, the Inupiat culture remains strong.
A lot of people always say, well, you got this and that, maybe you're not native no more. That's stupid, you know. The idea of us being a community and a people is that we are still together, we still live our lifestyle, and we still depend on the land and the oceans for all the nutritional needs that we need. And we're more happy about this having our native foods and we would from cans and stuff like that. Yeah.
Matumiak deletes the caribou, whale, fish, and other foods he gathered as a boy, well before outboard motors made it much easier to get. While back in the city, I'm rolling up the aisle looking at the canned soup. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
Our culture series is funded by the Alaska Humanities Forum. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had help tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ann Hillman in Nuiqsut. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and intern Alex DeWare from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.